Welcome to the My Buddy Green podcast. I'm Jason Wachob, founder and co-CEO of My Buddy Green, and your host. If you're a listener of this show, you know how critical maintaining lean muscle mass is as you age. And that's why I am so excited that we've launched our grass-fed whey protein isolate plus in vanilla and chocolate. It is clean and pure grass-fed protein with no fillers, and it's got 25 grams of bioavailable complete protein, including leucine, the critical amino acid which you need to maintain and build lean muscle mass. I take our protein powder twice a day, every day. I love it, and I know you will too. So go to shop.mindbodygreen.com/whey20 to get 20% off your first order of grass-fed whey protein isolate plus. We always say food is medicine, but food is so much more about the nutrients that fuel your body. Food is connection. It's love. It's identity. Everything that goes into making a meal is arguably just as important as the food itself, not to mention who you share it with. Today, we have Kimbal Musk back on the show to discuss all his cooking tips as a professional chef, like cooking perfect soft scrambled eggs, plus his insider views on what makes for a magical restaurant experience. Besides being a professional chef, Kimbal is a philanthropist and entrepreneur. His personal mission is to empower and invest in the next generation who are building a healthier, happier future. He is the co-founder of one of my favorite restaurants, The Kitchen, the nonprofit Big Green, a 501c3 that believes growing food changes lives, and Square Roots, which is an urban farm company growing fresh, local greens in climate-controlled shipping containers with the mission to bring real food to people in cities by empowering next-gen farmers. Lastly, he's also on the board for Tesla, which, yes, his brother Elon is the CEO. So most restaurants you go to, you look at the menu, pretty innocuous. You'll see burger, salmon. Maybe there's a description of, you know, the side salad or whatever accompanies the main dish. However, when I had the pleasure of dining at your restaurant, The Kitchen, I was a little bit surprised to see Nessie Bessie as a menu item. So could we talk about Nessie Bessie and the significance behind that choice?
Well, The Kitchen is a restaurant in Boulder, Colorado. Been around for 20 years. We really love the concept of connecting with local farmers. Our farmers have animals. They raise animals. And we also have a very strong following amongst vegetarians and vegans. And there was this push from the vegetarians and vegans to have, you know, less meat on the menu, things like that. And what we thought would be It turned out we ended up becoming even more hated, I think, but then more loved at the end, so it was a good ending. But we thought it would be a good idea to raise our own animals and serve them on the menu, because that would give us a better connection to our animals. And if we're going to serve meat, we should know that it came from an animal. And so we raised animals. We have pigs. We raised rhubarb and custard, and we had lamb, which was Nessie and Bessie, and we raised them all the way to slaughter, and it was quite an experience to take that and put it on the menu. But instead of just putting lamb with couscous on the menu, we said Nessie and Bessie with couscous. And that's where we got this complete uproar about us serving or putting the name of the animal on the menu. And this came from the vegetarian vegan community. But actually, what ended up really positive was we actually said, well, this is our reasoning. We want to have a better connection with the animal. We want our guests to have an awareness that this was an animal that gave up their life for this meal. And when we kind of got them to think along that perspective, there was this outpouring of understanding and love, and it built us. I think it really got us deeper into the community in Boulder. We now have a restaurant in Denver and Chicago. We're opening one in Austin, but Boulder is where it all started. And the experience taught me so much as well. Like I obviously love, I love animal protein. I love meat and I love lamb. And it was quite a thing to put Nessie and Bessie on the menu. And it was okay as well. It was a thing. And I think that was the goal. It was like, we wanted to give people a real connection, a true connection to the food they're eating, from a local farm, growing and raising animals in the best way possible. And it's an animal.
You know, it is beautiful in some way. I think about the circle of life. I think about becoming more conscious around the decisions you're making at the table, whether it's at home or at a restaurant. It's understanding that there was an animal, and this animal lived a life, and this animal had a name, and just being, you know, having that awareness, whether you're vegan, vegetarian, or an omnivore, is powerful. It's this idea of really knowing your farmer, having that connection to food, becoming more conscious about your choices.
Also, the farmers we work with are very much regenerative farmers, which is a concept of really improving the soil. And that includes animals. You can't do it without it, without them. So it's not like the farmers would need the animals anyway. So let's use the animals in a way that is more, we're more connected to them, versus, you know, you got it in a McDonald's box or in plastic wrap at the grocery store. So it actually was a thing that it was going to be anyway. So let's have fun with it. When I say have fun with this, have a little humor. And it did and didn't work for us, but it was definitely a memorable experience.
Yes, yes. And so you mentioned regenerative soil, and we've talked about regenerative farming on the show, but in my view, we never talk about it enough. You know, in some circles, there's a view that animals are not part of the solution when it comes to climate change. And I disagree. I believe you disagree. And this is where regenerative farming comes in, and knowing this is a passion of yours and climate change is a passion of yours as well. Could we just spend a moment on regenerative farming and soil and why you're so optimistic, myself included, on this practice?
Well, first of all, regenerative farming is a bit of a confusing term, because people will say the regenerative when there really isn't a strong definition. So I think it's just good to have some basis in it, which is this concept of no-till. So you're not pulling the soil up, and that releases a lot of the carbon into the atmosphere. You have cover crops, meaning that you, in between seasons, you'll put in some clover and others into the soil and just let them grow, and then you kind of put them back into the soil for harvest. But one of the other ones is rotational grazing of animals. So the animals are doing the more what is, you know, a natural thing, where they would spend a little bit of time on one area, they poop on that area, they stamp it up with their feet, and they move to the next area. And that rotational grazing is what keeps the soil, combined with the cover crops, keeps the soil healthy. And it's better for the climate. It helps sequestrate carbon, and it also just makes for better growing environment for food. So it is put tied together. It's not really like we have a choice. I think the only thing we could say, which I do think is a fair argument, is we should not do the industrial farming of animals, where it is very much depletive to the soil, very much depletive to the environment. And I think that there's a good point there.
Yes, agreed. And I think a lot of your work, what I love about what you do, and I'll hold up the cookbook. The cookbook is amazing. That's why you're here, The Kitchen. You know, there's, you make conscious choices around, you know, what you put in your restaurants, how you spend your time. And one of the things I think is so critical, especially now as a parent, are our children. And something that you've been a huge proponent of is helping kids really understand where their food comes from. More specifically, let's get children to grow food. So can you spend a moment talking about that?
Yeah, it's a beautiful nonprofit that started about 14 years ago, so 2010. I had a very serious accident, life-changing accident, and just said, you know, I've all this this network, I have this experience, I have some wealth, and I should give back. And it was really a very powerful message to do that. And sort of to look at ways I could help in a way that I understood. And kids growing food is one of the most beautiful things you could ever see. And anyone who has kids, I hope your school has a school garden. Go out and volunteer, go get into that garden and just feel the joy that these kids get from growing their own food. They'll grow food that is as simple as a cherry tomato and more complicated like fennel or kale and things like that. And they will eat it all. It doesn't really matter what comes out of that soil. They'll eat it. So I love it. And over the past few, so 14 years, I guess, first 10 years of it was dedicated to building the outdoor environment, building these school gardens. And then the past 4 years, it's been now that we have our model in place, we have this beautiful equipment that is tried and true, been at it now for over 10 years. Now what we do is we raise funds and we fund local nonprofits to go build those gardens in schools as well as homes. And then another thing, which for me, I love, it relates very much to my love of the restaurant business, is this concept of the gathering place. I love, and I've seen your work as well around building deep relationships with people and how valuable that is to having a better life. And so we also have this concept of using gardens as gathering, like garden tea parties or fundraising events for other events, not necessarily for growing, maybe. But this idea of using the garden as a gathering place has just been absolutely wonderful. And helping our communities connect with each other, whether it's some of these neighborhoods are really tough, many of them actually are, and this is a calm, peaceful, secure place for you to go connect as a community, and it's really beautiful.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that. I think during COVID, and I encourage everyone first to go back and listen to the episode that we did with you, where you talked extensively about your accident, because wow, that was a serious accident. And there's a powerful story there, so everyone go back to that episode. We'll leave it in the show notes. But, during COVID, when we had you on, restaurants were hit very hard. And I think many people maybe discounted the role restaurants played beyond getting a meal, getting great food. And I love your perspective here that in certain communities, restaurants really are the pillars. They are where families gather. They're the place where these strong connections are made over years. And I think it's an important lens to have as we think about the restaurants in our community and the role they play. Do you think we're kind of getting that now?
I believe so. I think there was a lot of, a lot of difficulties around the pandemic, and let's talk about it as little as possible because we all want to move past it. but one of the things we certainly didn't like about it was that we couldn't be with our friends and our family. We were forced to sit in our basement, watch TV, and wrap ourselves in cotton wool. I was like, man, that sucks. When it comes to purpose and the meaning of life and so forth, I really found purpose with restaurants 20 years ago. And then I moved to other things. In fact, working at the nonprofit as well was really powerful for me. But I had slowly slipped away from the power of purpose that I had in my restaurants until the pandemic happened. And I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. When these are taken away from me, I'm devastated. I have lost my way to connect with my community. I could invite a few people to my house, but even that was not great. But even if you want to, there's this energy that comes from eating out in your community where you're around, literally eating with dinner around, surrounded by strangers. And it's that gives you a vibrancy that we absolutely was taken away from us. So I think that not only does the world appreciate it, but I personally really appreciated it, and it got me back into the business. It got me inspired to do the cookbook. We've got these incredible recipes of 20 years, and home cooking has become more of a deal. I love cooking at home. In fact, it's one of the main reasons I did the cookbook, but also. By when I spent time on the restaurants and the kitchen had been around for two decades, we've got some great recipes in there. And it was kind of a way for me to share why I do what I do. And here are the recipes that are my favorite from 20 years. We serve farm-to-table share plates. It's kind of like a farm-to-table version of Nobu kind of thing. We have a high-end shared plates, but you know, we can, it's wonderful about farm to table. You can pull in flavors from spices and flavors from anywhere, but you're doing your best to source as sustainably as possible. So 20 years later, like, okay, wow, I want to not just have a book of recipes. I want to tell people why I care. And it does come back to cooking for each other and building those deep relationships. Those deep relationships that you're going to keep with you, whether it's with your kids or whether it's your parents or with your friends or your husband or wife, keep with you forever.
So something I know is important to you on the subject of deep relationships and kids, the power of the kitchen table and eating with your family. Let's talk about that one.
Absolutely. So I try to cook at least one meal a day because I just enjoy the meditative process. And my kids are now, I have two 21-year-old stepkids. One is a stepkid, one is biological, and then one 18-year-old and one 11-year-old. And we have been eating together at the table. It's usually breakfast or dinner. We don't, because we're not usually together at lunch. And it has been such a gift. You know, my mom has taught me this when I was growing up. It's like, what advice do you have for me as a parent? And she said, Your kids will be your best friends if you let them and if you invest in them. And I was like, that's interesting. Because clearly my mom had done that with us. I'm going to learn from that. And so I use cooking for that. I cook with my kids and we sit down. If it's at breakfast, we share briefly for just a moment what we're excited about for the day. And if it's dinner, we share briefly what we're grateful for. And then we have our meal together, and there's no obligation in a sense that I do want people to sit down to eat together. But if you're just going to be there for a couple of minutes, it's okay. Because you're kids, you've got other things to do, your homework, but you are going to sit down for that first moment of gratitude or excitement. And that is just building deep friendships with my kids that I know in my heart will serve me for the rest of my life. And I think that is, I couldn't say enough good things about it.
I think it speaks to this deeper connection between food and love, whether it's love for your family or community.
And I really do love cooking. I love food. And I consider food like a gift we give ourselves three times a day. And whenever, let's make it good. But whenever I get like a bad meal, I'm like, wow, what a missed opportunity. Like I lost that lunch and I'll never get it back.
Do you think you can tell if a meal was, you know, cooked with love or maybe cooked with spite or anger? Does that come across?
Absolutely can tell. Especially when I go out to restaurants that I know well and I can tell the level of love and purpose they put into that specific plate that they just served.
What's like a giveaway for someone listening who's like intrigued now?
Yeah, totally. So a giveaway would be portions are too large. So that's a giveaway that they're not thinking about what they're putting on the plate. You really want a balance of something on your plate. You don't want it to be what I call a pile of food. Like that's not actually a good thing. You want someone to thoughtfully put it together. I'm not suggesting like you're using tweezers or anything, just a thoughtful balance of the food. And that actually is dead giveaway.
So, you know, there's so much that goes into that experience when you're dining out. You know, it's the food, it's the service, it's the ambiance, the decor, the server, the music, everything. It's like a symphony. I'm curious, what's your view for like what makes that experience great? What are the must-haves and also like what's the magic?
Well, I think it's a great question. I would say everyone has a different recipe for the magic. Excuse the pun, but I like to think about it from the perspective of the little special moments that a guest has. So one of them when you walk in, a special moment is the host they'll greet you. And that host has an opportunity to set you off in a good direction. Then you're going to look up and you're going to see the lighting. And is the lighting balanced and warm for that time of day? But what people don't realize is that you actually need brighter lights earlier in the evening and darker lights later in the evening, because it's really about balancing the eye and making it feel warm. So again, coming back to the love of someone putting love into the restaurant, if a general manager isn't putting love into it, those lights will be off. And that's one thing that we pay a lot of attention to. So you want a warm lighting. And then as you walk through the restaurant, it's got to make sense proportion wise. So you want to feel like it can't be too dense, but it can't be too sparse. So those are a whole bunch of steps that before you even sit down, you're going to feel the music. So you're not going to hear the music. So how does it feel? What's the vibe? Is where the music comes to. It's not like a song you recognize. It's like, what is the music making you feel? So we look for that. And then of course you have the food process and the service process. That all is, I think most people would understand that. But another touch is when you walk into the restroom, that's an opportunity we have with you for a minute or 2 minutes or maybe a little longer, but not much, but it's a real moment of presence. Okay. That's another opportunity to give you a real splash of energy. And so like throughout the night, you've just got these sort of twinkles of lights, the feeling of the music, these moments where you get there, put people's attention, and you look after it, and then you create this energy that you go, wow, that was a great experience.
It's fascinating. The restroom too is a big one. No one likes walking into a restroom that, you know, clearly hasn't been cleaned.
Of course, exactly. Oh, and it's such an opportunity to just also have some fun with it.
You know, there's one restroom, and you'll appreciate this given you're from South Africa. I forget the name of the restaurant. This was like a decade ago. The restaurant, unfortunately, has since closed. It was this cool South African restaurant in downtown Miami, and not a great neighborhood. And I'll never forget, the bathroom was like coolly decorated, and there was this sign that the owner had put in the bathroom, and it was something along the lines of, the bathroom you were in is the size of Nelson Mandela's cell.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's powerful.
And he sat here, you know, for how many decades, and just like provide a little perspective about the, you know, and it was just so, it's like the one bat to this day. I don't remember it was fun, but I remember that bathroom, and what a powerful moment, extreme, but powerful.
Yep. No, I love building an emotional connection with the guests, and you clearly got one there. And it's actually at the end of the day, I think that's what it's all about. You know, whether it's a cookbook, what's the emotional connection? Or if it's kids in gardens, what's the emotional connection? Or if it's a restaurant, what's the emotional connection?
Yes. And you know, something we know, and I'll segue to our next subject, but I just think, you know, I think a lot about my routine. You know, I'm health forward. This is what I do. This is my life. It's my work. And I eat pretty clean. I exercise. I meditate. I do all the things. I do all the blood work. And we're going to segue to your blood work. But for my wife and I, eating out is a part of our health routine. Like, we love dining out at restaurants. Do we do it every night? No, we've got two little kids. We probably do it twice a week. But it's critical. Like, if we were to create a list of what's important to us in our wellness routine, eating out is definitely one of those things. I never really thought about that way until, you know, connecting with you recently. And I was like, you know what, this is something for many people. This is part of their, you know, quote unquote longevity protocol. It's eating out with friends and family. It's important.
Totally. I would add that people, if you're cooking at home with friends and family, also a win. I mean, I love people coming out to my restaurant, and I also love people cooking at home. And the cookbook is a way to let people experience the food we have, which is I'm very proud of our restaurants. Food's very good. And of course, still requires put love into it every time. You know, the food doesn't cook itself, but but it's very good. And so the recipes are really great for people to cook at home as well. What I love about your reflection on your relationship with your wife is you guys go out to dinner, you go out to eat, and it's sort of, you know, breaking bread with friends. You might have a glass of wine. You might be meeting some people for the first time. You might also, if you were single, you might find someone you will spend the rest of your life with. out of a restaurant. We've had the most extraordinary marriage proposals in our restaurant that'll just like, they're just incredible. And the restaurants are just what, they're just these community gatherings, that gathering places that are wonderful, absolutely wonderful.
Yes. And something my wife and I both used to do when we were single, the magic of just walking into a restaurant and sitting at the bar and having a meal.
Yeah. Great.
Pre-smartphones, but like you would just start talking to people and you build relationships. It's one of the things when we go out to dinner without our children, we love to sit at the bar and just maybe have a drink and just meet other people. It's fantastic.
It's great. I totally agree. And then you can connect with the community even more.
Yes. And so, okay, longevity, blood work. You did some blood work with our mutual friend, Dr. Mark Hyman, who we love, has been on the show numerous times. And you had some interesting findings and also some interesting next steps in how you viewed that blood work and how it was going to impact your life. So let's talk about that.
Yeah, well, first of all, I'm a very curious guy. And Mark is a wonderful human, good, very, very good friend of mine. And, you know, I was very curious to learn what the blood work could do to help me live a better life and be physically in better shape. I mean, I love being in good shape, but it's a constant work in progress. And it was actually during COVID, so we had time. So I asked Mark if he would, I asked him, like, what does he suggest? And he said, well, because it's COVID, why don't you just come to my house? And we spent a week there with some really good friends. It was also just nice to hang out and eating amazing food. He's such a good chef. His food was so good. And we just hung out. It was in Massachusetts, very, very chill, doing all of the blood work while we were there. And I get this call a few weeks later from Mark saying, dude, we got to talk. And I was like, okay, well, what is it? You got this gluten allergy, like your blood work is really extreme. And I was like, oh, fine. I don't really feel that way necessarily, but let me learn more. And he connected me to a doctor at Harvard who took me through gluten intolerance, how it all works. And I was curious about it. And one of the things the doctor said was, you know, when you have gluten, how do you feel? And I was like, well, it's actually, sometimes I feel fine and sometimes I don't, but it also matters what I eat. If I have a big bowl of pasta, I'm probably going to not feel that fine. If I have a slice of toast, I'm probably going to feel fine. And so I couldn't say it's gluten. It'd be more like, let's look at the full picture, not just the gluten part. And so he said, well, you know, one way to find out is you go off gluten for 3 months. And all of this was, he wouldn't charge me for this because he was also curious. He was like, just check in with me once a week. And this wasn't Mark, this was the other doctor. And I thought about it. And I went back at this nice offer to go do it for 3 months. And then I called him back and I said, so what happens if I am gluten intolerant? And he said, well, then you shouldn't eat bread or pasta and those things. And I was like, okay, now I really have to think about it. So then I called Mark, and this is where it gets a little funny. So I said, Mark, so if I'm gluten intolerant, I've got to stop eating what I love, which is, and by the way, the bread that I eat is good bread. It's not Wonder Bread or something. It's good bread. And the pasta is good pasta, well-sourced and so forth. And I said, you know, so what you're saying is like, I won't be able to eat that anymore. And he's like, yep, but you'll feel much better. And I said, okay, well, the thing is though, I have hay fever. And the quick and easy answer for me to not experience allergies is to not go out into nature. And I have hay fever, so it's not like I have a choice. So why would I stop going out into nature just because I have hay fever? Because I love nature. And so I was like, well, because nature is kind of like bread and pasta less of it, bread for sure. But nature is kind of like bread for me. I love bread. I don't eat it in mass quantities, but I love it. And when it's done well by a great baker, or in our restaurants, we do it in a wood oven. I mean, it makes my mouth just water just even talking about it.
Yes, me too.
the reward for being for my allergy is to not have bread. It's like my reward for having hay fever is to knock out into the nature. It's like, no, I'm still going to go out into nature. and I'm still going to eat bread and it's going to be okay.
I love it. You know, I think it's such great perspective. And we've talked about elimination diets and people who have autoimmune. And look, sometimes you have to take drastic measures and I get it. But I also think you can't underestimate the power of food and the joy it can bring you. And whether it's the delicious sourdough bread or in the other example you provided, getting out in nature, you have hay fever. That's real. You can't live your life in fear. You can't live your life depressed.
I know that one well because I end up getting injections. Like you can get these allergy injections once a week. And after about 6 years, I was like, man, I'm just really tired of these injections. And so I stopped getting these injections and I got the hay fever. I mean, I still had hay fever with the injections, but they're like these special, you know, Western medicine kind of thing where they give you a little bit of the hay fever in the injection, very small amount. So your body gets built up a tolerance to it and you just don't have as much hay fever. But then you have to have injections and that sucked. So I was like, okay, I want to kind of learn that my life is, my body is what my body is. I want to be in nature. I don't want injections. All right. So I'll take a Zyrtec D when I have hay fever. Okay. I think that's a whole of the options. That's the best option, not hiding from nature and not going to the doctor every week and getting an injection.
Yes. And also not having, not having bread again wasn't an option for you. That would not bring you joy.
No, it just wasn't an option. I mean, for me, I also have so much respect for bakers out there that are really good. It is so beautiful breaking open a loaf of bread that is freshly baked and drizzling it with a little olive oil. It's just, or a slab of butter. It is just not something I would want out of my life. Let's put it that way.
So back to the cookbook. You know, a lot of people struggle with time. Do you have a favorite go-to recipe when you're short on time? You got 5 to 10 minutes, you need to whip something up for dinner?
Yeah, we have quite a few recipes in there that are easy if you're short on time. I will be honest, my favorite one is a little bit less about time and more about minimal amount of work. So if you take a chicken, like if a whole chicken and you put some salt, pepper on, olive oil, and put it in the oven, that's literally the work you have to do and it'll be done in an hour. You'll have a great roast chicken. You know, if you want some vegetables, throw them in the pan as well. So that's in our cookbook and it's just remarkable how, I mean, we have some wonderful twists on it that we do and that'll make it the best one you've ever had. But fundamentally, it's about, the simplicity of putting something in the oven. So I love those kind of recipes where when I've got my family at home, whether it's 3 or 4 of us, or sometimes it's 30 of us, I use the oven a lot and I'll put things in the oven and just do some preparation ahead of time. And I'm not really spending much time to cook this meal. It's just very simply being done in the oven. There are some other wonderful dishes in there that use the oven. Like we have this roasted carrots with an urfa dressing. And it's a very unique spice that is just remarkable and so easy to do. Just roast those carrots in the oven and dress them. And it's that sort of simplicity that I love. What I've learned, obviously I'm a trained chef, so I don't want to suggest that it's super easy for everyone else, but I have learned to multitask so that when I'm cooking for my kids or others, I'm not like just cooking. Like I'm actually cooking and I'm working on other things. And that's again where I come back to using the oven or use slow cooking to manage that. The one exception, which I love, it's my favorite thing to cook and it's the simplest, quickest thing to cook, is my soft scrambled eggs recipe, which is in the cookbook. And that is one where it only takes 2 minutes, but it is total meditative focus. There is no multitasking because you got to get it right. And I must have cooked that recipe minimum thousands of times. And every single time I do it, I know if I take my eye off the ball for 1 second, it won't be what I want it to be. And there's an important message with eggs. It's like eggs are what you want it to be. So like everyone has a slightly different version of what works for them. But but focus. And I use it as an opportunity in the morning to kind of have this meditative way to start the day.
So on the subject of eggs, it's one that's so simple, but you can get wrong easily. Where do people go wrong with cooking eggs?
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons, but I would say the number one reason is people don't practice. So when you think about the amount of times people do eggs, people cook eggs fairly often, but that's not the same as practicing. So there's a great lesson from the 10,000 hours guy, that Malcolm Gladwell. It's not 10,000 hours of doing the sport. It's 10,000 hours where each hour is with an intent to learn. And that's a very important distinction. So if you are going in and practicing soft scrambled eggs, which is what I love, fried eggs or poached eggs or others, if you actually go in and practice 4 or 5 times using some good recipe books to give you some guidance, just the internet to give you some guidance, you're going to be fine. But what happens is every time people approach cooking eggs, they don't take the time to say, what am I going to learn about this this one? And of all of the things out there, eggs is one of those things that it's actually, you got to practice. And you get it right, it's everyone's like, they're just remarkable. Well, how do you make these eggs so good? And like, all right, come and watch me. And they watch me like, well, that seems really easy. So yes, it is actually. It's very easy. And it takes thousands and thousands of times of practice. That's how it is for me. There's other things that happen with eggs that you've got to really think about the pan you're using and to use that same pan every single time you practice, because a different pan will give you a different result. People don't realize that. They're so delicate in how they cook.
Interesting. What's your pan of choice for eggs?
I mean, honestly, it's very simple. One of those sort of nonstick pans, but it has to be a relatively new one, because within about a year, those will not, they won't work as well.
Yeah, you got to be careful too. If you don't get the right brand, the toxins.
No, you got to be really careful. Exactly.
Yeah, the ceramic ones are good. Any tips or tricks for vegetables? That one is always challenging. You mentioned the carrots, and you know, we have little children, and sometimes getting them to eat vegetables is a challenge. So we'll do things like cut up the carrots so they look like French fries, and put them in the oven with salt and olive oil. Any tricks for vegetables?
So I think one of the greatest lessons about vegetables is people often eat vegetables raw, and they eat them all the way to cooked. So people think to themselves, well, I've got to cook vegetables. No, actually, if you want to eat vegetables, sometimes a raw carrot tastes just great. And cooking it, you can cook it for 5 minutes, you can cook it for an hour, and you're just going to slowly adjust the flavor of that carrot. For my kids, if I give them boiled carrots, they'll throw up at the table, and they love carrots. Why? Seriously. But if I give them raw carrots, it'll work. If I roast the carrots, it'll work. Because I love roasting, you know, salt and olive oil in the oven for an hour, and you'll give a little kind of, it'll caramelize it a little bit, dehydrate it a little bit, adds a bit more sugars to the flavor. But you don't have to do much to vegetables. I think the major mistake that people make with vegetables is overcooking vegetables. And even I struggle to eat an overcooked vegetable. It's overcooked broccoli, overcooked carrots, overcooked squash, actually, it's funny. That's a good one. Squash, I think, was the reason why I learned to cook in the first place. When I was 11 years old, my mother would serve us boiled squash without salt. I mean, it's like, man, that is just a prison sentence for a child. There's just no way you can get through that without gagging. And so I really think carefully about seasoning and how long you, this is when it comes to cooking for kids. Of course, it matters for adults too, but when it comes to cooking for kids, is season it well. Appreciate that, like carrots are a good example. Squash is another one. There's actually a lot of sugars in those, so it actually needs more salt than a broccoli. Broccoli needs very little salt. Carrots and squash actually need quite a lot of salt to balance out the sugars. And you don't want to cook it too long or it becomes a little mushy. So a couple of little rules of thumb there is don't overcook your vegetables, and season them well with salt, and you're 90% of the way there to having a happy audience.
I love it. What about tips for cooking meat?
So I would say the best recipe I've ever had for, it's in our cookbook, but it's so simple that I can share it here. The best recipe that I've had for a steak is salt and pepper on both sides. You put it into a medium hot pan with olive oil, and you lay the steak down, and you don't move it. You don't even touch it for, depending on how much you like your steak, for 5 to 10 minutes, and it gets a nice, wonderful golden brown, even a little darker brown, not burnt, but darker brown, a crust on the outside. And then you carefully flip it, and you do the other side, and you really are not moving the steak at all. So fundamentally, what you're doing with the steak is you are trying to avoid the juices from running out of the steak, so that when you eventually eat it, it's not sort of that dry texture. And so you're fundamentally not moving the steak. That's number one. And then the other one is you take it and you take the pan off the heat, or you could take the steak off the pan carefully. And you'd also do your best not to move it much. And you let it sit for another 5 minutes before you touch it. And anyone who has cooked steak, including me, has made the mistake of cutting the steak too soon. And it'll just, all the juices will just run all over your cutting board. And you want the least amount of that to happen as possible. So it's the most important thing to remember is to move your steak as little as possible. Salt, pepper, olive oil. You could flip it, of course. You have to do that. And then you need to let it sit for, let's say, 5 to 10 minutes, even longer, it'll be better, before you cut it and serve it, or before you eat it. And it's just worlds of difference in the experience.
Great tip. Do you have a favorite cut?
New York strip. Yeah, New York strip is my favorite cut.
Okay.
Yeah, it's also like, for me, I've always found it, because we work a lot with farmers, is I'll have them send me that cut. Kind of goes back to practicing, you know, practicing with eggs and pans. And when you're practicing, you really want to have as few variables as possible. So in scrambled eggs, pick a pan that you're going to use a lot and do your eggs in that pan always. In the case of a steak, what I have found is if I work with farmers and I only ask for that cut, then I learn a lot about how they're raising the animal, what's the style. Our farmers, they're not industrial farmers, so they'll adjust. They'll do a unique recipe that they'll feed their animals in terms of how many months are they grass fed, how many months are they fed with corn. And then all the way to 100% grass-fed, all the way to most of our farmers are majority grass-fed, but some of them, we actually have found that when you feed them corn at the end, that the flavor really does improve. But by having the same cut each time, I can learn.
You know, you often hear that from chefs when you talk about grass-fed. It's many share the view that feeding some corn at the end really helps with the taste.
Yeah, I also, because we work locally, not always, but as often as possible, some farms are really good for grass-fed. Some farms are really not good. So like, it's grass-fed is like you're eating grass. So I think that it's also important to appreciate that in some parts of the country, it's going to be way better to finish them on corn. And in some parts of the country, it's going to be great grass-fed.
Right. So zooming out, you're a busy guy. You are involved in a lot. You're involved, obviously, with the kitchen. You've got this cookbook. You work with a variety of startups and food. You're involved in philanthropy. You also work with veterans and underserved. Talk about underserved. That group is, unfortunately, a lot of veterans feel like they're almost vilified. Can we talk about veterans specifically and your work there?
Yeah. My wife, Christiana, she has had a lot of PTSD in her life. And as working together as philanthropists, we really wanted to help people out there with mental health that came from PTSD. And frankly, women have a lot of PTSD, but it's actually, we're struggling to find organizations that will speak loudly. When I say loudly, represent them well. But what we have learned in that process was this, these veterans, especially in Colorado, where we have a wonderful veteran community, and they they really, I wouldn't say that they're vilified, but I will say that it's not like they're coming home heroes. You know what I mean? There's a difference there. And I was, and it's creating a profound sadness. You know, they had a real purpose. You talk so much about purpose, and I love that. And these folks have a ton of purpose, and they come home, and it's kind of a void. They're not heroes. They're not greeted as heroes, and I don't think they even necessarily are expecting that. But to be greeted with nothing is quite jarring for them. And so we've been working with them on mental health, going into the veterans hospitals and working with a lot of therapeutic aids. Colorado is progressive in that way, where people can use psychedelics. Veterans are allowed to use psychedelics as part of their mental health improvements, in conjunction with a therapist, in conjunction with integration afterwards. We're big believers that can be really helpful if it's done correctly. And Colorado is where it's working very well, and they're continuing to build better systems. And that's where we have really found remarkable progress. And proud to say we've helped quite a few veterans get on a good path.
It's fantastic. So in addition, you also work with Tesla, SpaceX. These are big ideas. You know, you're a big idea guy. What is your big hope with food?
Well, I've actually always loved food as a passion, because it's one of those unsolvable problems. Unlike most things, you can say to yourself, well, even in alternative energy, I guess we'll eventually have all solar. And actually, food is different. Food is it's everything from a matter of opinion to what geography are you in. We can always be healthier. I mean, you're the best example of this. You know, your audience wants to be healthier. You can always be healthier. You could take being healthy to a bad place, but for the most part, being healthy is a good thing. And so for me, food is this wonderful, it's kind of like playing music. I also play music. I'm an amateur musician, there's no end. There's no end to it. There's no end to me just to discovering music. There's no end to how you can learn to play the same song again. There's no end to the fact that you're going to have a different audience every time. And the food is very much like that. I love my scrambled eggs in the morning, not just because occasionally I might have a different audience. My daughter, who's 11, and she and I will have breakfast together quite often. We feel differently every day. Like, not, you don't feel the same every day. And so, it's also kind of cool that even when you're cooking for yourself, it's a different audience every time. And so I love the never-ending learning, whether you're learning about the food you're cooking or learning about yourself, or you're learning about your friends. It's a never-ending learning journey.
So on that never-ending learning journey is definitely your brother. He's, you know, arguably, I think he's a lifelong learner for sure, arguably one of the most recognizable and impactful entrepreneurs of our time. You know, as you know, along with fame and fortune, often comes pressure and scrutiny. And I'm curious, how do you manage that? The outside noise, the stressors, attention of being Elon's brother.
Well, I mean, I think what people who are not me don't appreciate me is I've grown up with my brother. I love my brother. He's a savant in ways that it's hard to explain. I mean, like, obviously, clearly in the results of what he does. But a savant doesn't mean he's like a perfect human. No one is perfect. So when you put someone under the microscope, it's pretty easy to find some challenges. But when you have someone I think he would self describe it as some form of Asperger's syndrome. It's going to be a little bit easier for people to take shots. So I feel a lot of empathy for my brother. But I love him dearly. And I'm also really honored to be kind of, I don't know, like the Scottie Pippen to Michael Jordan. It's kind of fun. Like, I'm just, I'm like, pass me the ball every now and then. Great. Or I'll pass it back. But like, can you show me how to do that dunk again? Because I sure as hell can't do it, but I am damn impressed every time I do.
Does he have a favorite recipe in the book?
My brother loves, I've got to say, he loves the eggs. That's probably what it's the simplest things.
So on that note, like, how do you define success? What does that look like for you now?
It's a great question. You know, I love this Picasso quote, which is it's on the meaning of life, and his quote is, "The meaning of life is to find your gift, and the purpose of life is to give it away." And I just have really resonated with that. Rather than think about purpose and so forth, I've got to like have something to prove, which I definitely had that in my younger times, or I've got to go solve this problem for other people. It's more of a gift to give away. And for me, it is the gathering place. It is connecting people together. And it is, whether it's in my restaurants, whether it's cooking at home with my family, or whether it's Big Green, our gatherings we do with our gardens, or if it's even at Tesla. I mean, that's funny. I mean, I would cook for our board over the years. When we're dealing with a really tough problem, it's like, I'll just come over and cook while we all talk about stuff. It's the gathering place that has been this beautiful gift that I've learned I can give, and I just love giving it away.
Beautiful. I'm curious, in the future, what concerns you and what excites you?
I think there's a lot of worrying out there right now, and it is a tough year. None of us, I can't imagine any of us want Trump and Biden to be again in this election. Ugh. I won't comment on politics, but to say it will be a tough year. So I think it will be tough. But I really believe in the resilience, especially in America. This is a very resilient society. I grew up in apartheid South Africa. I grew up in a tough, tough situation, and it was brutal, and I couldn't wait to get out of there. And I've watched America go through, as a spectator, because I was living here, but I was a spectator because I wasn't a citizen, and also just grateful to be here. Such a great country. But it kind of goes through its difficult times as well, just like anyone else. And it's resilient. And I think the resilience in America really gives me a lot of hope. I think that as a humanity, we're also very resilient. And I think a lot of the alarmist approaches comes back to the gluten-free, let's ring the bell, we're gluten-free. Well, wait a minute, hold on a sec. Is it okay, we can have a slice of bread every now and then? You know, so I think the alarmism is too much for me, having gone through the experiences that I've gone through. I had this great conversation once with a friend of mine who was constantly worried about things. And it was 2020. And this was sometime in January 2020, he'd said, "I just think the sky is going to fall this year. Like, we're just, everything's going to collapse and everything's going to be bad." And I'm like, man, you really need to take a chill pill, and you should be a little bit more optimistic. And 6 months later, I'm back with this guy, and the sky had fallen, and the world was now under pandemic, and it was all of this stuff, and he was totally right. And I asked him, "So how do you feel?" He's like, "I feel fine." It's like, okay, so maybe you don't have to worry so much about the skies falling, because you're probably going to feel fine.
Made yourself miserable for the 3 months preceding the pandemic.
Exactly. Well, I mean, not just that, all the years before that, he was just constantly convincing himself that it was just going to be so bad. And actually, when it did actually get bad, he actually was fine.
So we covered a lot of ground today. Other than pick up the book, which I encourage everyone to do, any closing words of wisdom or anything you want to touch on before we leave?
I'm excited for folks to try the cookbook. Just search Kimball Musk cookbook and you'll pick it up online. Buy it in your local bookstore. Please support your local bookstores. And can't wait to hear your feedback.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Kimball.
That's great.